This is Holden Karnofsky doing an amateur read-through of my blog post, Minimal Trust Investigations. This is about the single activity that seems to have been most formative for the way I think. Most of what I believe is mostly based on trusting other people. For example, I brush my teeth twice a day. Even though I've never read a study on the effects of brushing one's teeth, I've never tried to see what happens when I don't brush my teeth, and I have no idea what's in toothpaste. It seems like most reasonable-seeming people think it's worth brushing your teeth, and that's about the only reason I do it. I believe climate change is real and important, and that official forecasts of it are probably reasonably close to the best one can do. I have read a bunch of arguments and counterarguments about this, but ultimately I couldn't tell you much about how the climatologist models actually work, or specifically what's wrong with the various skeptical points people raise. Most of my belief in climate change comes from noticing who is on each side of the argument and how they argue, not what they say. So it comes mostly from deciding whom to trust. Now, I think it's completely reasonable to form the vast majority of one's beliefs based on trust like that. I really don't think there's any alternative. But I also think it's a good idea to occasionally do a minimal trust investigation, to suspend my trust in others and dig as deeply into a question as I can. This is not the same as taking a class or even reading and thinking about both sides of debate. It is always enormously more work than that. I think the vast majority of people, even within communities that have rationality and critical inquiry as central parts of their identity, have never done a minimal trust investigation. Minimal trust investigation is probably the single activity that's been most formative for the way I think. I think the value is twofold. First, it helps me develop intuitions for what, whom, when, and why to trust, in order to approximate the views I would hold if I could understand things myself. Second, it is a demonstration and reminder of just how much work minimal trust investigations take, and just how much I therefore have to rely on trust to get by in the world. Without this kind of reminder, it's easy to casually feel as though I understand things based on a few memes or talking points. But the occasional minimal trust investigation reminds me that memes and talking points are never enough to understand an issue, so my views are necessarily either based on a huge amount of work or on trusting someone. In the rest of the piece, I will first give an example of a minimal trust investigation I've done and list some other types of minimal trust investigations one could do. And then I'll discuss a bit how I try to get by in a world where nearly all my beliefs ultimately need to come down to trusting someone. Next section. Example minimal trust investigations. Detailed example from GiveWell. I'll start with the case that long-lasting insecticide-treated nets, abbreviated as LLINs, and I'll just say nets when I'm reading this because that's better than saying LLINs, are a cheap and effective way of preventing malaria. I helped investigate this claim in the early years of GiveWell, which I linked to. It's an organization that I co-founded. My discussion will be pretty detailed, but hopefully skimmable, in order to give a tangible sense of the process and twists and turns of a minimal trust investigation. Here's how I'd summarize the broad outline of the case that most moderately familiar with the topic people would give. So this is what I think most people would say. I think this is slightly inaccurate, but I think it is the most common case people would cite who are casually interested in the topic. So it goes like this. People sleep under nets, which are treated with insecticide. And I have a picture of that. The netting can block mosquitoes from biting people while they sleep. The insecticide also deters and kills mosquitoes. A number of studies show that nets reduce malaria cases and death. These studies are rigorous. Nets were randomly distributed to some people and not others, allowing a clean experiment. The key studies are summarized in a Cochrane review, the gold standard of evidence reviews, concluding that there is a saving of 5.6 lives each year for every 1,000 children protected. Nets cost a few dollars, so a charity doing net distribution is probably saving lives very cost-effectively. Perhaps the biggest concern is that people might not be using the nets properly, or aren't using them at all. Maybe they're using them for fishing or something else unintended. So that's the case I think most people would give, and when I did a minimal trust investigation of this case, I developed a picture of the situation that is pretty similar to the above, but with some important differences. Actually, of all the minimal trust investigations I've done in my life, this is among the cases where I learned the least. That is, where the initial and conventional wisdom picture held up best. So here's what I did to investigate this basic case. First, I read the Cochrane review, that's the literature review that summarizes the studies, in its entirety, and read many of the studies it referenced as well. Some were quite old and hard to track down. I learned a few things that I hadn't realized. First, the original studies of nets involved very intense measures to make sure people were using their nets properly. In some cases, these included daily or weekly visits to check usage. Now, modern-day net distributions don't do anything like this. This made me realize that we can't assume a charity's net distributions are resulting in proper usage of nets. We need to investigate modern-day net usage separately. Second, the most recent randomized study of nets was completed in 2001, and there won't necessarily ever be another one. And I have a footnote explaining why that is, and I think it's generally due to ethics concerns about randomizing something that's believed to be effective. In fact, none of the studies were actually done on the kind of nets that are used today. They were done on nets treated with non-long-lasting insecticide, which had to be retreated periodically. This made me realize that anything that's changed since 2001 could change the results observed in the studies. Changes could include how prevalent malaria is in the first place. If it's fallen for other reasons, nets might do less good than the studies would imply. How the technology of the nets has changed, such as moving to the long-lasting insecticide approach, and the possibility that mosquitoes have evolved resistance to the insecticide since the studies were done. So these points opened up a lot of further investigation because we then attempted to determine whether modern-day net distributions have similar effects to those observed in the studies from 2001 and earlier. We searched for general data on modern-day net usage, on changes in malaria prevalence, and on insecticide resistance. This data was often scattered, so we had to put a lot of work into consolidating everything we could find into a single analysis. And it was often hard to interpret. We couldn't tell how data had been collected, how reliable it was. For example, a lot of the statistics on usage of nets relied on simply asking people questions about their bed net usage, and it was hard to know whether people might just be saying what they thought the interviews wanted to hear. We generally worked to get the raw data and the full details of how the data was collected to understand how it might be misleading. We tried to learn about the ins and outs of how nets are designed and how they compare to the kinds of nets that were in the studies. This included things like reviewing product descriptions from the net manufacturers. We did live visits to modern-day net distributions, observing the distribution process, the nets hanging in homes, etc. This was a very imperfect way of learning, since our presence on site was keenly felt by everyone. But we still made observations such as, it seems like this distribution process would allow people to get and hoard extra nets if they wanted, and a lot of nets from a while ago have a lot of holes in them. We asked net distribution charities to provide us with whatever data they had on how their nets were being used, and whether they were in fact reducing malaria. Many of the charities we talked to were not very responsive on this point. One, Against Malaria Foundation, was more responsive. It was able to share pictures of nets being handed out and hung up from its distributions. But at the time, Against Malaria Foundation did not have any data on before and after malaria cases or deaths in the regions it was working in, or on whether nets remained in use in the months or years following distribution. Later on, it would add processes for the latter and did some of the former, though malaria case data is noisy and we ultimately were not able to make much of it. We've observed from post-distribution data that it is common for nets to have huge holes in them after a while. We believe that the insecticide is actually doing most of the work, and in the original studies, that's also what was happening. So simply killing many mosquitoes could be the most important way that nets help. I can't remember how we came to this conclusion. We spoke with a number of people about our questions and reservations. Some people made claims like, nets are extremely proven. It's not just those experimental studies. It's that we see drops in malaria in every context where they're handed out. But we looked for data and studies on that point, put a lot of work into understanding them, and ultimately came away unconvinced. Among other things, there was at least one case in which people were using malaria data that was actually estimates of malaria cases. And the estimates were based on the assumption that malaria would be lower where more nets had been distributed. So they were assuming nets reduced malaria, then using that assumption to generate numbers, then using those numbers as evidence that nets reduced malaria. A quote from the GiveWell website says, using this model to show that malaria control had an impact may be circular. My current understanding of nets, which is outdated because it's based on work I did a while ago, my current picture has a lot of doubt in it. I am worried about the possibility that mosquitoes have developed resistance to the insecticides being used. There is some suggestive evidence that resistance is on the rise and no definitive evidence that nets are still effective against it. Fortunately, nets with next generation insecticides are now in use, and at the time I did the work, they were in development. So that has hopefully been patched. I think that people are probably using their nets as intended around 60 to 80% of the time, which is comparable to the usage rates from the original studies. This is based both on broad cross-country surveys and on specific reporting from the Against Malaria Foundation. Because of this, I think it's simultaneously the case that a lot of nets go unused or misused, and that nets are still probably having roughly the effects we estimate. But I do remain nervous that real net usage could be much lower than the data indicates. As an aside, sometimes there's a lot of attention on whether people are using their nets as fishing nets. That's often kind of considered a scandal. I'm pretty underwhelmed by this concern. It's a very media-worthy concern, but I'm more worried about just people like not bothering to hang up their net. I would guess that's much more common. The usage data we use is theoretically accounting for both problems. Finally, I wish we had better data on malaria case rates by region so we could understand which regions are most in need of nets and look for suggestive evidence that nets are or are not working. Gibble has recently written about further progress on this. So, a lot of concerns, a lot of complexity, but all in all, the case for nets holds up pretty well. It's reasonably close to the simpler case I gave at the top of the section. For GiveWell, this end result is the exception, not the rule. Most of the time, a minimal trust investigation of some charitable intervention, reading every study, thinking about how they might mislead, tracking down all the data that bears on the charity's activities and practice, is far more complicated than the above and leads to a lot more doubt. So that was a detailed example of a minimal trust investigation, how all the questions it raised. Here are some other examples. So some other domains I've done minimal trust investigations in: medicine, nutrition, quantitative social science, including economics. I've grouped these together because a lot of the methods are similar. This is usually consisted of finding recent summaries of research, tracking down and reading all the way through the original studies, thinking of ways the studies might be misleading, and investigating those separately, often hunting down details of the studies that are not in the papers. I link to a number of write-ups from doing this kind of research, although I will say I don't think reading such pieces is a substitute for doing a minimal trust investigation oneself. The blog post series I've recently been putting out, called Has Life Gotten Better, has a pretty minimal trust spirit. I haven't always checked the details of how data was collected, but I've generally dug down on claims about quality of life until I could get to systematically collected data, and in the process, I found a lot of bad arguments floating around. Other areas I've done some minimal trust investigations in, there's analytic philosophy, so you can do a sort of minimal trust investigation without a huge time investment in philosophy, because the main evidence presented for a view is generally in the form of intuitive arguments and thought experiments that a reader can evaluate themselves. For example, a book like The Conscious Mind, which I link to, more or less walks a layperson reader through everything needed to consider its claims about consciousness. I think it's best to read multiple philosophers disagreeing with each other about a particular question and try to form one's own view of which arguments seem right and what's wrong with the ones that seem wrong. Another category, finance and theoretical economics. I've occasionally tried to understand some well-known result in theoretical economics by reading through a paper, trying to understand the assumptions needed to generate the result, and working through the math with some examples. I've often needed to read other papers and commentary in order to notice assumptions that are not flagged by the authors. Another kind of minimal trust investigation is checking attribution. This is a simple, low-time commitment sort of investigation. When person A criticizes person B for saying X, I sometimes find the place where person B supposedly said this thing, and I read thoroughly, and I try to determine whether they've been fairly characterized. This doesn't require having a view on who's right, only whether person B seems to have meant what person A says they did. Similarly, when someone summarizes a link or quotes a headline, I often follow a trail of links for a while, reading carefully to decide whether the link summary gives an accurate impression. I've generally been surprised by how often I think people and links are mischaracterized. Honestly, at this point, I don't trust claims of the form person A said X by default, almost no matter who is making them, and even when a quote is provided, since it's so often out of context. And then here are some minimal trust investigation categories, some other areas I wish I could do them in. History. It would be interesting to examine some debate about a particular historical event, reviewing all of the primary sources that either side refers to. Hard sciences. For example, taking some established finding in physics, such as the Schrödinger equation or Maxwell's equations, and trying to understand how the experimental evidence at the time supported this finding and what other interpretations could have been argued for. Reference sources and statistics, so I wish I had time to take a major Wikipedia page and check all of its claims myself. or try to understand as much detail as possible about how some official statistic is calculated, like U.S. population or GDP, where the possible inaccuracies lie, and how much I end up trusting the statistic as a whole. In AI, I'd like to replicate some key experimental finding by building my own model, perhaps incorporating a resource that I link to, trying to understand each piece of what's going on and seeing what goes differently if I make changes, rather than trusting an existing recipe to work. You could apply the same idea to building other things to see how they work. So this has been a bunch of different categories. Minimal trust investigations, they look different from domain to domain. I generally expect them to involve a combination of trying to understand or build things from the ground up and considering multiple opposing points of view and tracing disagreements back to primary sources, objective evidence, etc. An important property of all minimal trust investigations is trying to get all the way to a strong understanding of the topic, so that one can, within the narrow slice one has investigated, keep up with experts. I don't think exposure to this sort of thing, minimal trust investigations, ever comes naturally via formal education or reading a book. I do think it comes naturally as part of some jobs for some domains. Next section, navigating trust. Minimal trust investigations are extremely time-consuming, and I can't do them that often. 99% of what I believe is based on trust of some form, but minimal trust investigation is a useful tool in deciding what, whom, when, and why to trust. Doing minimal trust investigations in some domain helps me develop intuitions about what sort of thing usually checks out in that domain. For example, in social sciences, I've developed some intuitions such as, first, selection bias effects are everywhere, and they make it really hard to draw much from non-experimental data. For example, eating vegetables is associated with a lot of positive life outcomes, but my current view is that this is because the sort of people who eat lots of vegetables are also the sort of people who do lots of other things one is supposed to do. So people who eat vegetables probably have all kinds of other things going for them. This kind of dynamic seems to be everywhere. Most claims about medicine or nutrition that are based on biological mechanisms, like particular proteins or organs serving particular functions, seem unreliable. Many of the most successful drugs were found by trial and error, and their mechanism remained mysterious long after they were found. Overall, most claims that X is proven or evidence-backed are overstated. Social science is usually complex and inconclusive, and a single study is almost never determinative. When I'm done going through all the evidence on some social science topic, I often feel it's quite inconclusive, and I often end up falling back partly on intuitions about what I would guess if there were no evidence. These are different from what I would have guessed before I started investigating. I have a lot of intuitions that I picked up via trust. For example, I have the intuition that vegetables are good for you, or at least I did, and that's not something I'd believe by default if there were no evidence for it. The kind of intuitions I do trust a bit more are things like spending more on X will tend to make X accomplish its objectives better, or X will become less demanded and expensive when there is more of it, or if X happened in most previous cases, X will probably happen in this case, even if there is some story about why this time is different. Those are the sorts of things I would believe if there were just no evidence either way and no one to trust, and such intuitions often play a big role in my final conclusions. Now some notes on trusting people. When trying to understand topic X, I often pick a relatively small part of the topic to get deep into in a minimal trust way. I then look for people who seem to be reasoning well about the parts of the topic I understand, and I put trust in them on other parts of the topic. I've applied this to hiring and management, as well as to forming a picture of which scholars, intellectuals, etc. to trust. There's room for a lot of judgment in how to do this well. It's easy to misunderstand the part of a topic I've gotten deep into, since I lack the level of context an expert would have, and there might be some people who understand the topic very well overall, but don't happen to have gotten into the weeds in the subset I'm focused on. I usually look for people who seem thoughtful, open-minded, and responsive about the parts of the topic I've gotten deep into, rather than agreeing with me per se. Over time, I've developed intuitions about how to decide whom to trust on what. For example, I think the ideal person to trust on a topic is someone who combines A, obsessive dedication to the topic, with huge amounts of time poured into learning about it, B, a tendency to do minimal trust investigations themselves when it comes to the topic, C, a tendency to look at any given problem from multiple angles rather than using a single framework, and hence an interest in basically every school of thought on the topic in question. For example, if I'm deciding whom to trust about baseball predictions, I'd prefer someone who voraciously studies advanced baseball statistics and watches a huge number of baseball games, rather than someone who relies on one type of knowledge or the other. Conclusion. I think minimal trust investigations tend to be highly time-consuming, so it's impractical to rely on them across the board. But I think they are very useful for forming intuitions about what, whom, when, and why to trust. And I think the more different domains and styles one gets to try them for, the better. This is the single practice I found most useful, subjectively, for improving my ability to understand the world, and I wish I could do more of it.